Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I'm going to welcome my other co-hosts. Please welcome first the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com and co-host of the TV Break podcast on that same channel, Alex Marcus. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Justin.
Very nice to be back with you again. And we're also back with our other co-host, the co-host of the Pod on the Rooftops podcast about the rock band Genesis, on which I am also a prominent member, Noah France. Hello, Noah.
Hey.
Good to be back with you both. And we are here on Cinema Joes. This is a podcast where we talk about recent films we've been watching, a featured review on a movie, and a broader topic related to that movie. And this week, we have a special episode on Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Make sure I want to get that title, the full title, because that's how we like to play it.
Yeah, and
yeah, I mean, got to do justice to this.
To the legend.
And something that I think... for me, as someone who didn't know anything about this, like, wanted to make sure I got right. And it's definitely something that we'll get into. I think this is a film that having very low expectations, but also seeing the acclaim, was hotly anticipated by me. And so I'm sure we'll get into all of that.
Hotly anticipated low expectation film. I can't wait to hear.
Well, I should say, after I saw everything, all the good word that was spreading about it. But before we get into that film, we're going to be doing our full disclosure segment. This is where we talk about recent things we've been watching. They can be movies, but they could also be TV. They could be web series. They could be just about anything. They just can't be the thing that we're doing our featured review on. So I want to start this time with you, Noah. What's been good for you recently?
Well, I don't know if I've mentioned it on this show before, but after my wife and I got into the Chinese wuxia drama series, The Untamed, which came out on Netflix, which was released on Netflix, I think, a year and a half ago. My wife then discovered that one of the main actors is also kind of something like an idol star in China and Korea, and was part of a Korean boy band, similar along the lines of BTS, and is a trained dancer and singer, and that he has been a leader and a captain on the last couple seasons of a show called Street Dance of China, which is basically a competition show for street dancers. Its fourth season is in the middle of being released now. And after the past three seasons, so the third season we watched last year, the two of us, and really liked it. And the fourth season is going on now. They have a new episode coming out every Sunday, and they're available on YouTube. They're actually available with a pretty wide range of subtitles, including English. So we've been having a lot of fun watching that. It's street dance is something that I've never thought about or was into before. But really getting into it because of this show. It's just a lot of fun because the dancers are all cool and funny people. It's very positive. It is competitive, but in a positive sense. There's no artificially milked drama like in a lot of reality or competition shows like there is in the United States. Like, they're all just there because they love dancing. They love dancing with each other, and they're just happy to be dancing and showing the insane and ridiculous and amazing things that the human body is capable of. Not my body, but many other human bodies. So that's just a lot of fun. We eagerly look forward to the new episodes being released every Sunday. They are long. This is not US television where it's edited to within an inch of its life to, make room for enough commercials. Each episode is upwards of 3 hours and is released in several parts. So we can't sit through an episode in one sitting. We have to break it up in chunks. But it's just fun. It's a fun time. If you're at all able to appreciate good dancing and people having fun, doing good dancing, that it's a fun watch.
Wow, yeah, I don't think I would have ever heard of that without you talking about it. So once again, we have your wife to thank for giving us one of your recommendations.
Yeah, it's too bad that I recently moved to the town from Footloose, so I'm no longer allowed to appreciate good dancing. So
I'll have to pass. Well, hopefully you can find an abandoned...
Like Alex, if you put it on with like John Travolta jump through your wall and be like, you're a Scientologist now. Come with me.
That's Kevin Bacon, not John Travolta.
Isn't John Travolta in Footloose?
No.
Sorry. I'm thinking Saturday Night Fever. I was thinking of Saturday Night Fever.
Those are different movies.
I've never seen either movie.
Where did this come from?
Sorry, I've never seen either movie.
Stealing Kevin Bacon's credits, man. Jeez.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but only 1 degree, and it's Kevin Bacon.
Well, hopefully, Alex, you can find an abandoned farmhouse to do very angry gymnastics in. I hope that very much for you.
Currently scouting it out on Google Maps as we speak.
Awesome.
Abandoned mineshaft.
Well, that's cool. I'm really impressed. I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that that actor is multi-talented and had a showcase, because it sounds like, it sounds like he had like he's had a pretty extensive career. So, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's one of those people you're like, you hear the list of all the stuff he's done. You're like, okay, he's how old? Okay, what have I been doing with my life? But yeah, it's just fun. It's nice to see like I'm always happy when I see like those types of reality or competitive shows that don't like, try to milk up or gin up bad feelings or drama between like the people involved, you know?
Yeah.
Like it makes for a more fun viewing experience. You know, when you see like, oh, these people are there because they just like the craft and the artwork that they do, you know?
Right. Yeah, very cool.
Like the Great British Baking Show.
Yeah, no, that's another example, actually, where I appreciate that much more than quite a lot of American TV programming.
And F-Boy Island.
Oh, gosh. That's next on Stella's list, right, Noah?
I don't understand the question, and I won't
respond to it. Perfect. I was just going to ask you, Noah, where did you watch this? Is it
on YouTube?
Oh, okay. Sorry.
On YouTube. Yep.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. I'll go to you next, Alex. I assume you've been watching something similarly themed or something completely different.
Honestly, not that different. My movie that I'm going to talk about today is a movie I just watched yesterday. It's called The Eyes of Tammy Faye. It's the Tammy Faye Baker biopic, okay, directed by Mike Showalter and starring Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield. And yeah, it like weirdly has some similarity between what Noah was just talking about, in the sense that in the sense of like an unironic, sincere showmanship for the joy of like the art that you're participating in. That's kind of central to Tammy Faye Baker's life story.
Tying street dance in China to Christian evangelicalism.
Well, because the thing about Tammy Faye that you might not know unless you watch this movie is that she was motivated by a sincere love of singing and singing for the Lord, as she would say. And she believed that if you kind of reach out and touch people in this way, that is like spreading love and joy through the world. And she seemed to sincerely believe that. And this movie kind of captures that very empathetic quality that she had, and also a kind of extravagant showmanship that she also tended to have. And it kind of contrasts that a little bit with the sort of toxic televangelism that her husband kind of wrapped her into. Certainly, she is presented in this movie as a sympathetic figure, someone who may or may not have closed their eyes to the things that they didn't want to see was happening around them, or maybe sincerely were just naive. The movie kind of is ambivalent about that fact, but it ultimately is not that interested in a question of like moral culpability for the kind of crimes that her faith community perpetrated, because it really has this kind of very sympathetic lens towards her specifically and her outlook and what she cares about. And Showalter and Chastain, Jessica Chastain plays Tammy Faye Baker in the film. They do such an incredible job of capturing that essence of this character and making you care about her and making you see the world through her eyes, no pun intended. And it really makes you root for her, even if she might be a person who you would not necessarily think you would want to root for. It certainly also is a very damning portrait of her husband, Jim Baker, who is played by Andrew Garfield and is just kind of presented as a very weak man in every sense of the word. So I think that everyone is right that her performance is really excellent, and the movie does a good job of showcasing her. My complaint is that it doesn't really do much of anything else. It kind of feels like there's no movie around her performance. And they're like, the story is very much a kind of cradle to grave, rags to riches sort of tale, where like the highs and the lows, like you see her as a little kid, you see her in college, you see her through all of these different beats. And it's just like set piece to set piece to set piece flying through her biography. And I kind of wish that we had gotten more time in any of the settings and really focused and maybe found a way to tell her story through a more narrow lens than just this sort of like aggressive speeding through the timeline approach. Because ultimately there's not really much story there, because there's a lot of opportunity for story, but they never take the time to actually invest in any of the smaller narratives that you could actually flesh out. And instead it's just kind of like these bullet points scene after scene. But like I said, it doesn't take away from the performance and from the fact that it really genuinely feels like they captured this woman and her and took her seriously and treated her with respect and dignity in a way that she is often not treated in the press and in other media. And it also doesn't run away from the sort of garishness of her personal aesthetic either, in a way. It kind of takes on that at certain points, and it makes the case that this is a coherent vision of a person and not just a spectacle for us to kind of like laugh at or to feel sorry for. And I think that for that alone, it's worth watching. It's definitely not my favorite movie of the year. I kind of wanted it to be a bit better than it was, but the things that are good about it are exactly as good as I was hoping. It's just that there's not enough movie around it to justify it being kind of a higher ranked film for me.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'd heard, that was kind of a mixed bag of reactions to the movie. Wasn't it is it true that the movie, or at least the idea to make the movie, was partially inspired by the podcast you're wrong about?
I don't believe so. It's based off of a documentary from the year 2000, which has the same name. And it's heavily based off of that documentary. So I don't believe that it's related to a podcast.
Okay, darn it. Our influence has not yet waxed, my boys.
It tries to talk a little bit about her. Like, it tries to center her role as a rare evangelical who was pro-LGBT rights. It does that to sort of mixed results. I feel like they kind of just throw it in there a few times to be like, see, she actually isn't like these other people. But feels a bit superficial in how it's kind of grafted onto the story. I would have liked to see more of it if that was really a core part of her life and her ministry, instead of just people casually mentioning that that was the case and giving her like a couple of key scenes to dedicate that. But that feels more like an indication of like the problems with the movie overall, which is that there's only a couple of key scenes to give life to any particular part of her narrative, and that kind of takes away from investing in it as a real story versus just a highlight reel.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the American evangelical stances or opposition to LGBTQ rights is only one of the very destructive and poisonous aspects that that movement has had in American society. So I feel it's I could maybe see the thought process of wanting to use that to like excuse the character, but not acknowledge any of the other aspects that they may have been complicit in. But yeah, I don't know if, as the televangelist
of the 1980s, having like an AIDS patient on her show and giving him the opportunity to talk about how he came out of the closet and his relationship with his sexuality and what it's like to live with AIDS was a truly remarkable and brave thing that she did. And she does deserve credit for that.
That's right. I had heard about that.
Yeah, I had maybe, you know, being born at the tail end of the 80s, I was not familiar at all with this person until I heard about this movie. And I wasn't quite sure what to make of it, other than like I heard that Jessica Chastain was starring in it and that, you know, there was a lot more that I shouldn't just expect a sort of, you know, straight up satire given the subject matter. Mm. So I honestly can't say this is like one of my more anticipated films of the fall. But just hearing some of the things you're talking about, especially with maybe the nuances in that character, sounds intriguing to me. And, you know, as someone who had Jessica Chastain as my performer of the 2010s, it's like, how could I miss this movie?
Oh, so, that's right.
Yeah. And it's really something. Like, she gets the voice down in a way that's like is very impressive. The physicality of it. She has to sing. She has to do a lot of like comedy and a lot of drama and a lot of sort of heightened situations that could be that like veer on campiness, but she really manages to walk that line in a way that it really works. It's honestly a bit better than the movie probably deserves.
All right, so Alex, do you think this could be what gets Jessica Chastain her Oscar?
I mean, I think she certainly can get nominated for this performance. I don't know if she'll win. The Oscars are notoriously pro movies where people play real life figures. So that certainly is going to help her. But I think it's way too soon to see what the kind of shape of the Oscar season is going to look like. So I don't want to go out on a limb on that yet. But I think she could definitely get nominated at the very least.
Yeah.
Like, all for right. instance, I don't know, like, there's also, you know, Kristen Stewart as Diana, kind of just, like, running around in the background right now, so.
Well, has Hollywood forgiven her for the Twilight movies yet? I think that's going to be the big question.
Yes, everyone has forgiven her for the Twilight movies. They decided right. that those movies are secretly great, and she's excellent in them. Catch up, Noah.
Get off my lawn! All right, Justin.
All right, Well, I've got something a little bit different, I guess. It's a film that I just saw, or I guess didn't just see, but a film that I heard good things about, but was really still kind of pleasantly surprised by. It's a film called Together Together. This is written and directed by Nicole Beckwith. This is her second film. I believe it premiered at Sundance, and this stars Ed Helms, and an actress who is new to me, although I was looking up a lot of her credits. She's done a lot of voice stuff. She's a stand-up comic. Her name is Patty Harrison. She was actually apparently the chief of Tail in Raya and the Last Dragon, which I don't even remember who that character was, but apparently she was a voice in that movie. But she's really great in this, and so is Ed Helms. Like, this might be my favorite role of his that I've seen. It's nice to see him play a character who's like kind of sweet. The film is about the sort of premise of it is that it's a man who hires a surrogate. He is a single he's a single man. He hires a surrogate played by Harrison, and he ends up developing a surprisingly close friendship with this woman. And it's a really fascinating portrait of loneliness about these two people who have had some kind of like bad lots in life. Helms plays a character who is in a long-term relationship that ended very badly. And he's, you know, he's an old, like he's middle-aged and he's kind of feeling like he wants to have a family, and he doesn't know if he wants to wait to, you know, find the perfect partner for that to happen. He wants this as a part of his life. It's something he's wanted for a long time, which is why he ends up hiring a surrogate. And then you have Patty Harrison, who plays this character, Anna, who has had a kind of a tough life where she got pregnant when she was in college. This was especially this was very like scandalous for her family, who like ended up basically like she ended up becoming estranged from her family as a result of it, and has had to reckon with that and kind of pick up the pieces. And as a result, she didn't finish her she ended up having an abortion, which also was something that estranged her from her family. And she never finished her degree. So she's trying to like figure out her life. She's like in her mid-20s and she's kind of looking for like, what is her next step? And this is a way of getting money and, and hopefully funding her education. And I think it starts off and you think it's going to be a story about a, like this very like well-intentioned, but also ill-advised character of Ed Helms, who is, kind of not doesn't understand how to respect boundaries, even though like this person is, you know, is having his child. He's the kind of guy who will show up at her work and like buy her clogs because he heard that's like a really good thing for pregnant women to have and it makes them more comfortable. And it's like and she's like, well, I didn't ask for this, and like, why are you at my work? and you're kind of like, is this what the whole movie is going to be like? And no, luckily it's not. These characters both come into more focus as it goes along. And I think what's interesting to me about it is their relationship is, I think, is always platonic, but definitely is more intimate than you would expect of a friendship, like almost to a point where you're like, is this okay? And the film is kind of like, well, for these people it is. And it's something that I think we're so used to seeing relationships in movies that are very sort of clear cut, like this is a friendship, this is a romantic relationship, and this one is like kind of living in that weird nether space. And I think it's more accurate to the way some relationships in our own lives are, and I really like that about it, and I like that it's celebrating that. And on top of all that, it's just very funny. There's some nice like little parts from some comedic actresses. Tig Notaro shows up as a counselor, who is very funny because she's very like non-committal about giving advice. Like they kind of share these like very conflicting feelings, and she's like, oh, well, that's perfectly understandable, or like, oh, that's perfectly okay, like that makes sense that you're feeling that way. And it's like she's very like warm and understanding, but like also not very helpful. And then you've also got Sufi Bradshaw, who of course people will remember as Sue Wilson, the personal secretary to Selina Meyer in Veep, showing up as a pregnancy technician who just is so just cutting with very, you know, with like a very sort of passive aggressive line, and is clearly like trying to reckon with this very strange, especially at the point where they come in for to do her ultrasounds, especially at a point where their relationship is sort of figuring itself out and she's kind of in the middle of it. Some very funny scenes there. It definitely feels like a Sundance movie in some ways. It's very quirky. I don't know if all the humor works, but a lot of it does. And I think it just hinges so much on Helms and on Harrison and this relationship that they forge, which feels very unique. And that's something I really respected about the movie. So I definitely recommend this one. Stick with it if you think it's going to be one kind of movie, because I think it reveals itself as another better one.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely have that on my list. I know it's available on Hulu right now to watch, and so it's there for me to catch up on. But I've been kind of resistant to watching it because of everything that you said. It felt very much like a Sundance movie in a kind of very cliche sort of way, where you just watch it and you're just like, oh, okay, there's these two people and it's kind of like low stakes and kind of sad but kind of funny, and then the movie's over and, you know, it is what it is. I've been resistant to watching it. Also because Ed Helms is not necessarily my favorite. I don't hate him the way that many, many people hate him. I feel like if you've watched The Office during a certain period of time, you just loathe Ed Helms to the point that you can't take him in other things. I don't feel that way, but I'm not especially drawn towards him as a screen presence. So, yeah, I've been kind of resistant. But I'm interested to hear how much you enjoyed it. So
Yeah, and I'm not especially, like, I'm not a huge Ed Helms fan by any means. And this kind of, like, he kind of won me over in this. I'm like, oh, this is, he can do this too. Like, that's really fun. And really, really kind of sweet.
Did you ever see Cedar Rapids?
No, I have not.
Because this seems like kind of a follow-up to that sort of project for him.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I know I know there are certain people who are such, like, huge fans of that movie, and I'm always like, I feel like I'll check it out at a certain point, but I just wonder if I'm going to be disappointed given, like, some of the things I've heard about it from certain people, the hyperbolic praise. But yeah, it's I think this one is definitely worth your time, definitely worth checking out, and might surprise you as it did me. So from there, we're going to move on to our featured review of Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. This is directed by Destin Daniel Cretton, who I think we've talked about on this podcast before. I believe I did a whole thing on Short Term 12 as, like, my full disclosure once. And I don't know if I talked enough about how much, like, I love his direction in that film, especially some of the filmmaking techniques. But this is kind of a different, like, he's kind of bounced around a little bit. He's done some films that, like, you're kind of like, oh, that came out, I remember hearing about that, but then it came out and, like, no one really seemed to like it, and then it kind of disappeared, like The Glass Castle. Does anyone remember that was a movie?
I definitely watched that movie in theaters with my mom.
Did? Oh, wow. Okay. I did.
Yeah, and it's okay. It's fine. It's not as good as, like, it could be, yeah, for sure. Make the very bold choice of casting Naomi Watts as Brie Larson's mom, and, like, that's primarily because, like, it's in flashbacks, but then when she pops up as, like, when Brie Larson is an adult, they decide to not even try to make her look older than she is. They just put, like, a gray wig on her, and I just really respect that as a choice, because we all know that Naomi Watts is an ageless actress, so it totally...
Very true, very true. But yeah, this is his last film was Just Mercy, which I think I've maybe mentioned on this podcast before.
Saw that as well.
Yeah, it's fine. But I think I just want to start by asking you guys, just maybe we could do, like, a sort of quick hits sort of thing of, like, did you enjoy this movie? And I'll start with myself and say absolutely. So how about for you, Noah?
Oh, also, that's a double absolutely for me. Definitely upper tier in terms of Marvel movies. I think this is one of the best. I think this is one of the best of the origin stories that we've gotten in quite a while. I would still, yeah. I mean, Black Panther, Guardians 2, and Thor Ragnarok is still, like, my upper tier, but this is, like, this easily clears the second tier. And it would definitely be a top five, top 10, maybe even a top five if I were to do an up-to-date list of my favorite Marvel movies. Yeah. It's fun. It's funny. I really I think the way they combine kind of typical action and effects with a lot of wuxia elements from Chinese martial arts films and shows, I found that to be really effective. And yeah. I'm like, why did it take them this long to do this? The combination was there from the beginning, but we've got it now, and it's great. A lot of fun variety to it. Love the characters. Yeah, we'll get into specifics, but yeah. I've almost only positive things to say.
And how about you, Alex?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was great. It's one of my favorite movies of the year so far. It's just outside the top 10 for me in terms of my Marvel rankings. Mm-hmm. But, like, smack right in between the two Spider-Man movies, which you know that I love. And so, yeah, I loved it. I think Simu Liu is great as Shang-Chi. I think that Tony Leung is, of course, fantastic as his dad. Oh, I think that it's super fun. I really, really liked the first half of the movie, and I really like how the movie split into three sections, and I know some people feel differently about each of the three sections. I was on board with all three sections, so definitely strong recommend from me.
Yeah, I like I said, going into this, knew very little about this. I read up a little bit on the character, and it seems like there was a lot of things that were changed. There were some characters that were amalgamated from the comics. There were other elements that were sort of brought in. So it sounds like it seems kind of original in a certain sense, even though it is still drawing from the vast Marvel Comics mythology.
It's pretty much like a page run rewrite of the entire character and like his whole vibe. Like the only thing that they really kept was the idea that he is the son of a villain. And that's pretty much like that archetype is where they stopped. Everything else is sort of new. And I think they made some really smart decisions in that adaptation.
Yeah. And I did want to kind of ask you guys how you felt about just like the arc of this character. This is someone who's new to us. Like he is. I'm always fascinated anytime there's a new character introduced to the MCU of like, how are they going to fit into this universe? And so I was really just kind of not knowing what to expect. I kind of like that this is a character that we have to figure out over the course of the movie. We don't know everything about him from the beginning, and we have to learn and we have a certain perception of him based on information that's given to us that is then contradicted later on. So how did you feel just about the arc of this character and about the things that he has to work through?
I really enjoyed the choice to unveil the story in the way that they did, where you're kind of they chose Awkwafina as his best friend character. They gave you a couple of scenes very quickly early on to establish that relationship and how foundational it was for Shang-Chi. And from there, they rightfully placed us as the audience in the perspective of Awkwafina and not Simu Liu. Because, you know, she is kind of the most notable person for an American audience, probably in this cast. And she has a very likable and relatable presence. And I thought that was very smart. So you're kind of in her perspective for a lot of that first half of the film. And then, and so you're kind of trying to catch up to what exactly Shang-Chi knows, what is happening. But because you're invested in their relationship, you don't feel like the movie is withholding something from you. You feel like you are understanding something as you go along, and I think that's a really smart, subtle choice that I've seen used poorly in other films, where the mystery of the protagonist makes the protagonist into a bit of a cipher that you can't engage with. But the fact that he is not like meeting Awkwafina for the first time and like saving her life, and then she's finding out who this mystery man is, but actually like they've known each other for 15 years and they have a very strong emotional foundation to their relationship, it makes it easy to engage with. And something that Vanity Fair's Anthony Bresnikan always says on the Still Watching podcast, which I think is really smart observation, is that the way that Marvel gets you to care about its characters is by making its characters care about another person. Because when you get invested, when you see that they're invested in someone, it's easier for you to become invested in them. And I think that there's such a powerful relationship to that idea throughout this whole film that really starts with the Awkwafina character and moves forward as we go along.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Now, I have to say it's properly doing, you know, an audience POV character is not as easy as a lot of people assume, because it always kind of feels shoehorned in, or at some point you have to get an exposition dump to sort of just for the necessity of catching up the audience in the backstory. But it makes sense in the context of the film that he would have this close relationship and yet not have told her his big dark past. Cause I mean, in so many ways, this is a story about trauma, especially domestic within your family trauma and how people process and deal with that. And that very much is a coping or survival strategy when someone leaves that dynamic and goes somewhere else and they just shut it off. And that doesn't mean that, you know, them not revealing that to the new people in their life is them denying themselves, but that's one way of dealing with it, is to just shut it off and start completely new. So it would make perfect sense that you would have this really deep, close emotional connection with Katie, but not have told her any of this until the world literally bursts through the door and says, nope, you have to come clean now. The cat's out of the bag. And it also makes it more believable than you know, you have a lot of those cases where like some revelation is made about the main character and their best friend or friends will say, oh, well, we're still sticking by with you. It makes even more sense in this context that Awkwafina would stick herself out to that degree and say, like, no, I'm going to China with you. I'm not going to, like, you know, wait to quit my job or anything. I'm just leaving right now and I'm going with you. And it's more believable than I think in a lot of other movies that try that. Yeah, and that's the foundation. That's a foundational. They lay that stone at the beginning, and the fact that that stone is there grounds the rest of the movie after that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think also the idea of having an audience surrogate character, I think what some movies run into is that character just is kind of a cipher and like maybe even barely a character at all in the worst situations. And
yeah, or they're there in scenes and you're like, why is this character here? They're not important. You're like, well, we have to have the audience character there.
And Katie is not that. She's very much playing into, I think, a persona that we've seen Awkwafina do before in other movies, but it's something that's very specific, and yet very relatable. And I think having that, and especially seeing how Shang-Chi reacts, like the first time, like the first time in that bus fight scene, like what really makes sort of the tiger come out is seeing her get hurt and, you know, recognizing like this part of him that he's very much suppressed, because it's a part of himself that he loathes, has to come out when those that he loves are threatened. So I think that's really, and that's something that this movie really plays with, is this idea of the parts of yourself that are from your parents that you have to reckon with, that might also just be parts of you. And what does that mean? And I think that's something that this film really carries out and does a really good job of pretty much setting up from the beginning. And I also wanted to get your guys' opinion on that first fight scene between Wenwu and
Razor Blade
and Ying Li, Tony Leung and Fala Chen, who are Shang-Chi's father and mother respectively, because that was the moment where the film really won me over. I was like, oh,
the fourth moment.
I thought you were talking about the introduction of Razor Blade.
No, that's so early in the movie, so it's really exciting to hear that was the part that won you over. I thought that the first like 15 minutes of this movie were just kind of breathtaking. I was shocked by them. I couldn't believe how much they were willing as a Marvel movie to have non-English speaking dialogue, for instance, and have these just like throw you right into the lore of this world and have Tony Leung's character Wenwu just be there at the center and on this quest to this mythical place, and it all of a sudden you're in this wuxia movie, and it just is like, it's just a breathtaking kind of romantic fight dance that they're doing. It's like this courtship that is just really beautiful and also powerful, and I just really was shocked that they allowed all of that to happen so early in the movie and for it to be authentically non-English dialogue for that whole stretch, as we're learning about the family that our main character came from in a lot of respects. And I think that was such a smart choice. It really helped it helped with the authenticity of the experience. It helped you feel immersed into it. But I think it took a lot of guts to start the movie that way, because, you know, you're talking about a big American action adventure film, and it just is not, you know, you could see them getting cold feet and being like, well, I mean, do they have to speak Mandarin in this? Does the voiceover at least, could that be in English? And they don't really flinch with any of that stuff. They make it work, and as a result the world is a lot easier to buy into. And
the studios have been broadcasting for a while just how much they are salivating for Chinese consumer money and for getting the permission to stream and release their films within China. So there's
But this film is not allowed to be released in China. They were, because of censorship reasons, they were overly and they were not overly concerned as a Marvel obviously hoped that they could release in China because that would have been very lucrative for them, but they were not overly concerned with doctoring the film in order to appease the Chinese censors, and so it is not allowed to be released.
Do we know what specific points were, like, in contention? Was that ever said? Like, what specific parts of the films were...
The Chinese government just broadly condemned the film before its release, saying that it wouldn't be allowed to be released, saying that it kind of plays into unflattering depictions of Chinese, cultural figures, and plays into this idea that, like, all of China is just gangsters and evil people and whatever, which is not at all what this movie actually presents. It's incredibly sympathetic, but
towards the studio.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when they greenlit this movie a million years ago, they obviously hoped that they could release it in China, but they didn't. They were not allowed to, and, you know, I respect the fact that they didn't significantly change the film in order to appease them.
Okay, no, that is encouraging then.
And I really think that this movie, more than anything else, is made for the audience that they're courting is not necessarily a native Chinese audience, but an Asian American audience. You know, that's why Awkwafina, as an Asian American character, is your point of view person. You know, I feel like it's trying to, that there's this scene in the middle part of the movie, that kind of right at the start of the middle part of the movie, where they go over to China and they're finding Xia Lang's kind of underground fight club, right? And Awkwafina
It's very much above ground. It's high above the ground.
I suppose.
It's very
but
high
the
above.
Katie and Shang-Chi are in this elevator, and basically, like, Awkwafina gets to replay the elevator scene from The Farewell. Where she's just, like, subtly shamed for not being able to speak Chinese dialect well enough and just being a dumb American. And I was just like, I don't know how many people this is pinging for, but I really appreciate the connection between these two very different films about Asian experience.
Because that is especially for, I think, especially if you're second generation immigrant or refugee, that is very much a common phenomenon of you're not 100% from your parents' country and culture, like a little bit definitely, but you're also not 100% like wherever you are there. You're caught in between, and there's people on both sides could look at you and say, well, you're not properly this or that, you know? So they even if it's not explicit, dealing with that pressure and that concept of, oh man, I'm not really Chinese, I'm also not really American, or Chinese or Japanese or South African or Brazilian or like literally whatever, you know?
Right.
That is very much part of a certain generation of immigrant experience. So I think that will ping for a lot of people.
Yeah, I meant specifically like the making the connection to The Farewell, but I agree with you. The broader point is one that obviously is much more broadly relatable. And I mean, I'm not the one to speak on this, but there's been a lot of writing by Asian American critics in the last few weeks since this film has been released, talking about the things that this movie gets right about that experience that you're describing and the experience that they've had growing up in this country. And I think that it sounds like this film did a really good job of expressing this idea. And I feel like it's kind of integral to the story that Shang-Chi is going on, this sort of need to kind of marry these diverging aspects of his personality and his origin, and try to figure out how to balance all of that in order to become the hero that he knows he has to be. And I think that that's a really great hook for a movie, and I think that this movie really does a great job of expressing that story. I think it's really compelling, and I think that Simu Liu is really, really good in that role, and I just really, really like it. I think it's great.
I think the best Marvel movies, you know, like they all have action and CGI and, you know, these, you know, big scenic you know, these big expansive shots and all that, and that's here in spades too. But the best ones really do revolve around very, very powerful emotional cores. And they get those emotional cores right from the get-go, and that allows you to be invested. And so that's, you know, and that's, I think the best Marvel movies very much defy the stereotype of, oh, superhero movies are just, you know, lights and color and light shows and sound shows and nothing else. Like the best ones find that emotional core and center everything else around it.
And then you have something like this, which I think manages to do both of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. My slight criticism is I do find the big climax at the end to be a little, it's definitely more CGI and effects than like the more realistic martial arts style fighting in a lot of the earlier parts of the movie, which is part of the reason why I found a lot of the earlier action scenes to be just insanely good.
I don't disagree with that, although I will say, like, the things I probably most remember from the later scenes are the moments where you do see that fight choreography come back. Like, there's definitely moments where it's like a little blurry, I get what you're saying.
When the movie goes full on CGI, that's when it starts to lose me a little bit. That's why I'm in the process of writing my review. It's going to be in a three and a half star out of four. It's not going to be 4 out of 4. But so it's like there are slight moments where I'm like, I'm lost a bit now. But that's like my only real criticism.
Yeah, I guess I would say like there's a moment which is like, you know, when basically the ultimate baddie here is defeated. And I just remember like it's one of these moments of slow motion, which I think is deployed very deliberately and sparingly in a way that really works, really makes it stand out. And it's just this moment of calm for Shang-Chi as he unleashes basically the power of the Ten Rings and effectively makes the thing I can't remember the name of.
That guy go boom.
The demon. Oh, God damn it. What's it called? I should get the name right.
I'm trying to find it. I'm trying to find it for a minute. It's like the soul-sucker or the death killer or something. The Dweller in Darkness.
The Dweller in Darkness, thank you. Making the Dweller in Darkness effectively explode. But it's this moment of calm.
I gotta say, props to the movie for making that far more graphic than I expected.
Yeah. You see the various pieces all around, But I just love, like the slow motion and then this pose that he strikes, which is very much drawing upon what he's, I think, gained not just from his mother, but from his father as well, which is another thing I really love about this movie. And it's really effective as a result. So I think there are those moments where we do see that fight choreography in the midst of some sometimes murky CGI stuff. I think there's some stuff at night, which is always like, I mean, I like that. I don't think you shouldn't be able to do things at night, but it does sometimes make them a little harder to see. And I think there is a little bit of that. But I also liked I think there's just so much creativity in the designs of the creatures, too. And I think they look really good, especially in close-up. The moment of him, like, seeing the water dragon under was like, I was like, you know, people talk sometimes about how there's not enough wonder in the Marvel movies. And, like, this is a pretty firm rebuttal to that.
Absolutely. I have to say, I don't agree with you guys. I loved that it went crazy CGI at the end, because I just love the audacity of it, that they went that far, that they earned it. You know, they started out in Act One, this very street level sort of like we're fighting in a bus, and it's, you know, I mean, street level to a certain degree, right? But it feels very grounded. It feels very like emotionally connected and tethered to our reality, right? And then you progress into this sort of family melodrama that feels really well observed and earned in ways that I was very surprised by the subtlety of the dynamics that were being presented. It was not just like, oh, my dad is evil and I have to kill him. Like, it was very much like it really felt like you were seeing the inside of a family with complicated dynamics. And then you progress further into this magical realm where giant dragons have to fight each other, and it all felt it felt like they earned the spectacle by that point. And it really, I just appreciate the audacity of just going all in on a world and on world building, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I thought that not only were the parts where, you know, the action choreography worked there, but there was also a lot of really strong emotional beats in that sequence. You know, the moment where Shang-Chi has to decide whether to try to protect the water dragon from the dweller of the of death or whatever he is, or save his sister, and he decides he can't let his sister go because he abandoned her once and he won't do it again. That's like one of my favorite parts of the movie, and I think that but that only works because it's so friggin' batshit and crazy and just like over the top and so huge. But that matches the sort of like family like melodrama that's going on at the same time, that is just so pure of heart, and I really, really liked. And I think you kind of like, I just really respect that they went that far with it, and I think that it really helped me appreciate the movie even more. I certainly think that some of the CGI shots around the gate specifically were just like, they just looked like they were on a green screen. Like it felt like that sort of, that mapping did not really work very well for me, but who cares? Because like you have Tony Leung giving this incredibly emotional performance where he's like, I know that my dead wife is not behind that gate, but I could not live with myself if I didn't prove it to myself that she wasn't there. Like that's, and that's such like a, you could have so easily sold out that character and made him be this sort of like dummy who's like, well, he's being possessed by this or seduced by this magical spirit, and that's, and like, and that could almost seem insulting, but the way that Tony Leung plays that, it's like he knows that this is a doomed excursion, but he also knows that he could not live with himself if he didn't do it anyway, because he needs to know for sure. There can't be even a shadow of the doubt that his wife is behind those walls, and he's willing to destroy the world just for that like 1% chance that she's there. And he sells that and the emotionality of that so well. And then the redemption that he has when he chooses to save his son after previously choosing to kill his son is just, it's great family melodrama.
I was going to bring that up if you didn't mention it. The moment where he just, without saying any, with no dialogue, he transfers his rings to Shang-Chi. That's definitely a highlight of the big climax.
Yeah, and I there's a scene, so I want to maybe go into a little more detail, maybe, you know, after this, about Tony Leung, who I was just in awe of him the whole time. I'm just like, how is, like, this is like one of the best, like he is like one of the best. I don't even know if I want to call him a villain, though. Like that seems overly simplistic. But he was just like, just talking about someone who just like commands the screen, and he's able to do it like with very sort of like, even just his presence is enough to command your attention. And he doesn't even have to be doing anything like really special. But there's one scene, I think, which might speak to what you were talking about, Alex, of, you know, maybe recognizing intellectually that he can't save his wife, but wanting to do it, you know, wanting to go through with the process anyway, which is a moment when he hears her after he's told us that he's heard her voice and that he believes it's her. There's a scene of him alone, at least for a short period of time, where he hears her voice, and the film actually cuts to a scene of his wife, but seemingly not in the same room as him, but more like a memory. And it's done in such a way where it looks like they're kind of looking at each other, but they're never in the same shot together. And that's a moment where you're kind of like, oh, is this more of like a this seems more like a memory as opposed to something that's actually happening. And I think that kind of clues you in a little bit to the fact that this is just, at the end of the day, like this is just something that he wants to be, you know, that he wants to be true more than maybe believes it actually is true. I think that's very relatable. But I think it's also a moment where we start to see, like, to what extent really is this actually happening? And what extent is this just someone who has gotten pretty much what he wants for most of his life and can't live with it being taken away and move on?
Well, and I also think can't live with the regret of not being there to protect her.
Yes,
right?
And, like, the, and the guilt, yeah.
And so the only way to undo that regret is to save her, even if it's against all odds. And against reason, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, he's so fantastic. I mean, over the course of the summer, I watched all of Wong Kar-wai's films, and he is heavily featured in many of them, and he's just an incredible actor. People talk about him as one of the greatest actors of his generation, and I think that that is 100% accurate. This role is honestly, like, not worthy of his quality of acting, but he really elevates it, I think. I don't think it's poorly written. I think it's just written as a sort of, you know, morally complex villain, and he just amplifies it so much by just his presence and his ability to just, you know, he just acts everyone off the screen that he's around. Like, I think Simu Liu is really great as Shang-Chi. I think he was well cast. I think that the first third of that movie really works with his sort of, like, approachable sort of everyman quality mixed with his skill as a martial artist. But, like, when he's confronting Tony Leung, it's just, like, it's not even close. It's just Tony Leung just, like, wipes the floor with him.
That's very true. I think that is also par for the course with those types of family dynamics, where part of what makes them so toxic or damaging to the child is that the parent is so dominating and so overwhelming. And that dynamic just sort of feeds into that, you know? Like, you see Tony Leung and you're like, yes, of course, that's the sort of guy who would just completely overshadow his children for all of their growing up years. And, like, their childhoods, of course, would have been defined according to what he decided for them, you know?
Yeah, but he's just so good at conveying emotion. It's just incredible. Like, just with, like, a slight look in his eye, you get so much information that you just don't get from other actors. It's really remarkable. And he also has this swagger that he can pull off too. Like, I think he's most known for his kind of his iconic role in The Mood for Love, which is so much about this sort of, like, repressed emotionality. But he also can have so much swagger in his roles. And it's just is like, it's just really, he's so able to calculate, and his performance for the moment. And it's just, he's incredible. He's so good. I'm so glad that a lot of people who are not familiar with the kind of Hong Kong cinema that he is most known for are finally getting a chance to see his gifts, even if it has to be in a Marvel movie, you know?
It's very much, he perfectly embodies, you see him and you're like, oh yes, I can believe that that's a person who has lived for 1,000 years and seen everything and is just completely confident in his ability to survive anything that is...
Yeah, I mean, we haven't mentioned this, but Wanwu has lived for 1,000 years, probably didn't help with the rings, but that's not necessarily specified. And it's just like, you don't even question that. You really don't. You're not even it's just like, of course, Tony Leung is a timeless, immortal being. There's no question.
I got to say, one of my favorite, one of my favorite throwaway lines in the movie is when he's confronting the village in the alternate dimension. And the guy who's very clearly the elder, like, he's clearly the oldest human male from the village, is talking to him. And Tony Leung just says, "Watch your tone, young man." Or I forget what the exact line is, but he explicitly says young. Like, he either says boy or young man. You're like, oh wait, that's right. He's 10 times his age, even though he looks only half as old.
Yeah. I mean, we have to talk about Michelle Yeoh. I love Michelle Yeoh. She's so fantastic in everything that she does. I love that she gets to be the sort of mentor for this Simu Liu's character in that third act, and the sort of the training sequences that they have together, I think, are really, really well staged. What do you guys think?
Oh yeah, no, hard agree. I mean, do we get a scene between her and Tony Leung? I don't remember if we do.
Yeah, in that big confrontation when she, like, shows up, like,
well, she's a big confrontation
talking to each other before but the big fight starts.
But not the two of them together. I think that probably would have broken the film. If they had just those two alone in
front. The screen wouldn't have been able to contain it, that kind of thing.
The projector melts.
I loved her as well. I mean, I've loved her in pretty much everything she's been in. And here she's such a, like, just seeing her appear is just like okay, we're in good hands here. And actually for Shang-Chi, I guess literally, because that's actually part of what she's able to show him is his mother's way of fighting, which seems very drawn from Tai Chi. And I read that, you know, there were a bunch of actors here, in addition to other styles of martial arts, did extensive work in Tai Chi. And she just has this way of like being very comforting and yet also like making other characters confront hard truths. Like, I think she's part of the catalyst of Shang-Chi recognizing that he's had like that, you know, that good and evil exist in him and that he has to reckon with that. And I also just think that I gotta be honest, that there was a part of me that was thinking she was gonna die at some point during the battle, like at Tony Leung's hands, and I was gonna be very sad, but luckily that doesn't happen.
No, if they can't kill Tony Leung and Michelle Yao in the same movie. That's just like a hate crime.
That would have also broken the screen.
what are you doing? Like, I mean, if you're making a franchise, how would you kill both of those people off in the first movie? That would be very upsetting. Yeah.
I have seen some people theorize that the introduction of the multiverse will allow them to bring back Tony Leung in some form or fashion.
Which I mean, the introduction of the multiverse allows you to bring back anyone at any point if you want to, but they're different versions of those characters, so, you know, I don't... if you do bring them back, it's not going to be necessarily this particular person, but I don't see that happening. I think that he's not... Can I come back for a bunch of Marvel movies? I don't think he signed a 7-picture deal.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's kind of like with Killmonger's performance. I'm like, just let that be its own thing. Let that stand as just the masterpiece that it is.
Yeah, although the Killmonger episode of What If this week was actually pretty interesting. So, you know, multiverse has a ton of
this. Yeah, still got to catch up with that.
But in any case, before we move on, I did also want to briefly talk about another standout performer, which is Menger Zhang, who played Xiang Ling, who is Shang-Chi's sister. And this is her first film, which I don't know if you guys realize.
Wait, what? I did not know that. No.
What?
I know. She's incredible. I think that I think in a movie with like incredible performers, she really stands shoulder to shoulder with all of them. I love the dynamic that she has with her brother. I really like that her connection to him is very pure and but also very complicated. And I think it kind of like ricochets through her entire character to be this really complex figure at the center of the movie. And I'm excited that she's going to have a future in this franchise and potentially in the greater Marvel universe. As the new head of the Ten Rings, which if you stayed through the end, you'll know that is kind of what is established there. Shang-Chi seems to think that she is going to dismantle their father's empire, but it seems like she has other plans. And I really like that as a potential for a future film where you get to continue to have these sort of like messy family dynamics mixed in with the action stuff. And I think she just brought so much to the role. She was just so great at this kind of complex figure. Everything in that middle third of the movie is all about messy family dynamics, which is what Destin Daniel Cretton does so well in all of his films. Like, that is the kernel of what he is really excellent at. And I was surprised to see it featured so heavily in this movie. I thought it would kind of be a bit watered down, given the constraints of the type of film that we're talking about. But I think that it's really present. And I think that Menger Zhang is a big reason why it works so well.
Yeah, she's really wonderful. And I also love that she has her fight style is very unique. I looked this up later because I didn't know what it was called, even though I think I've seen it in other movies. But like her like weapon of choice is something called rope dart, which is almost like
perfect.
A combination of like a staff and you know, like a almost like a ball and chain or something, except it's all, you know, it's all rope. But yeah, it's just really cool to watch, and she has some great scenes, especially even like before the battle at Talo. She has some great scenes, just, you know, utterly decimating a bunch of bamboo sticks. So
yeah, I mean, her introductory scene is so great. I have to say this because I am on record as not liking flashback sequences for the most part, and just saying, like, trust your audience, to trust your actors, like, let them convey it. But I was really impressed by the way in which this movie utilized flashback to tell its story. I think that they placed them in such smart places in the film that I really, really enjoyed. And I think that the best example of that is the Xia Lang introduction, where kind of like she walks into that ring and they're about to fight, and then you get the flashback to everything that happened that led to her resentment towards him, and then it culminates in this kind of like punctuation mark of her just like kicking the shit out of him.
Yeah.
And it just, like, it's this great mix. I think that, like, in a lot of ways, that one sequence is everything that makes the movie so great. It's this combination of action choreography and family drama and heightened storytelling. It all kind of like blends into this one moment that works really well to establish as an introduction to a character, no less. It really, really works well. And I like that, like, she leaves him, but then she comes back. Like, there's a way where that could have seemed really contrived, but I felt like it felt really emotionally earned based on what we had just seen. And that the fight sequence that follows on the side of the building is really incredible. So yeah, I'm a big fan of her in this movie.
Yeah, and I just want to add, like, I really love the way this film uses choreography as part of its, like, not just part of its storytelling, but part of its emotionality. Like the scene, you know, the climactic scene when Shang-Chi is fighting his father and using the same techniques that we saw in that first scene between his mother and his father is so key. And it's one of those things where it's like you recognize that Wenwu has avoided, like part of the reason why he grew so distant from his children is because they reminded him of what he had lost, instead of seeing that, what if, you know, that this was actually maybe a way of keeping her alive to some extent. And I love that moment. I love that there seems to be that recognition in Tony Leung's performance in that moment. And I think it's just key to, like, what makes it. And I love that moment is, like, doesn't need to be communicated through words. It's all through the actual choreography. And that's something that's pretty consistent.
Yeah, sadly, the fight choreographer passed away just prior to the release of this film. And I think it's, you know, obviously it's especially sad when anyone passes away at any point. But I feel like the thing that so many people have walked away from this movie is like their first compliment to it is the fight choreography and how well staged it is and how exciting and how great the compositions are and how emotionally fulfilling it is and how much they use those action sequences to tell those stories and the specific, as you said, the specific fight styles and choreographies to tell the emotional story of these characters. And I think it's a real credit to, I believe it's Brad Allen who was responsible for that and who has unfortunately passed away. I believe the film is actually like has a little dedication at the end to him to reflect his contribution to the film. But yeah, it's really impressive. And it really is a stark contrast to a lot of superhero action where it really just sometimes feels like, okay, we're going to pause the movie for 7 minutes so we can have a big fight sequence. And then we're going to pick the movie back up afterwards, you know?
Yeah. As a sort of on a positive note as well, I should say I learned this just today when I was looking into some of the actors and actresses in the movie. Apparently, Menger Zhang married an action designer on this film who she met doing the movie. And supposedly they had there was a surprise wedding reception for them at Disneyland. Yeah, that was organized by the whole cast and crew, including the, you know, all of her co-stars. So that was pretty sweet.
So this was her first film and also where she met her future husband. That's really, yep. a really landmark event in her life was making this movie.
Yeah, I see it like this is, like you said, Alex, it is her first film. It looks like she's only done theater up to this point, not even television. So, you know.
Yeah. She's great. I can't wait to see what else she does in the future, because, I mean, I think she's going to obviously continue on in this franchise, but I hope she gets other opportunities to do other stuff, too, because she definitely has the chops. She's really, really great.
Yeah.
Speaking of acting chops, there's a dynamic duo in this film that we have not spoken about at all, and I feel like we would be remiss not to bring up before we close out, and that would be, of course, Morris and Trevor, the comedic...
Yes.
Duo of the film. Guys, well, what did you I'm really curious to know how that all worked for you.
Well, I'm one of those people who's I'm on record as being one of those people who actually liked what they did with Ben Kingsley and with the whole notion of the Mandarin in Iron Man 3. And I thought this was a great way that was from what I read, that at some point Shang-Chi was within the world of the comics descended from the Mandarin was his father in at least some version of the comics.
That's not from the comics. That's just a construction for the MCU. In the comics, oh, okay. he was the son of Fu Manchu, yeah. Which is a horrific Asian stereotype and just like really kind
right.
of.
Right, that is why they didn't include that in this movie.
Yeah, there's a yes. lot of reclamation going on. Anyway, I actually liked that the bait and switch that they did in Iron Man 3. And if you want to hear some more of my thoughts on that, then go back and watch our. How long has it been now? When did we revisit that movie? Was it this year?
That was like. Yeah, that was like 2 months ago.
Well, guys, time is meaningless. We're in a post-COVID world, so just a COVID world. Anyway, so I thought this was a very clever way to bring him back and to give us more of just that sweet Ben Kingsley comedic timing into the movie. I love the reaction of Shang-Chi and Katie to Morris, and then I love Ben Kingsley's reaction to their reaction. You can see Morris. Morris, I'm not hallucinating.
Yeah, that was a good reveal.
It's fantastic. I like it's kind of in a lot of ways he almost feels a little bit like Martin Freeman's character in Black Panther, where he's just sort of along for the ride and he's just there as comic relief, but and it's just the right amount. It's not excessive. They don't give him like some sort of outsized importance in the fight. But it's just enough to, you know, provide some levity in some key moments. So again, I thought that was great. I was happy to have both of them on board. Although yeah. if I were hunting in that safari zone, I would save my Pokeballs for the White Ninetales and not for the Morris.
Yeah, those are pretty cool. That was my immediate thought too. No, you were not alone.
Where are my Ultra Balls?
I thought he was well incorporated, and I think unlike Martin Freeman's character in Black Panther, he has does almost in terms of actual fighting, he does almost nothing. Help them get to it, so he's not useless necessarily. But
no, he like literally plays dead. That's what he does in the fight scene.
And I love that Morris like immediately catches on. That was really that was a really good thing.
Yeah.
Morris, also something I learned today, and Noah will definitely appreciate this, I hope. Morris, voiced by Dee Bradley Baker, who did all the animal voices in the Avatar series.
Oh, my God. Oh, man. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So oh, that's
he's
great.
He's definitely found a niche for himself. He is working constantly.
Yeah, that's... I mean, there's... The good thing is like the humor is spread around very evenly in the movie, I feel, but nothing tops that car conversation. Wait, when you saw Planet of the Apes, you actually believed that those apes were riding horses? Yes, I did.
Yeah, that was so the consensus is that's the funniest part of the whole movie. I thought that was fine. It was fine. I don't have any criticism of it. I was just surprised after watching it to hear how much people loved it, but you know, I'm very happy for you guys.
I would say it wasn't necessarily my favorite. I felt like it was maybe a little bit too prolonged, like it was almost like self-conscious But I still think he had some really hilarious moments. And I think that, I think also just as a guy who's like a character who's very intent on, you know, being an actor and like, but like seems to really love it. Like it doesn't seem to matter too much to him that he is, you know, the jester. Like he's still providing entertainment. Like he's doing
or that
what
he was used by a terrorist organization to further their ends.
Well,
he apologized for that. Yeah. He realizes that that was problematic and he should not have done that. Those are, if you haven't seen the film, those are basically his words.
Yeah.
But I fully expected that we would see Ben Kingsley in this movie as a cameo. When we see him in the sort of like whatever dungeon, I guess you could call it. Sure. I was like, oh, okay, this is how we're using him, and he's going to introduce this magical being that can lead them on their path and also sell a bunch of toys for Disney, and that's great for everybody. But then he's like stayed with them for the entire rest of the movie, and that was a big surprise for me. And I thought that it mostly worked. It kind of like walked that like razor thin line of being too much and not being too much, and I think that they erred on the correct side of that, but it was a real roller coaster for me. It was kind of like a harrowing experience to see if they would cross that line or not.
Yeah. I don't know.
It was kind of, honestly, it reminded me a bit of the way that Iron Man 3 uses the kid character, where like when the kid is introduced, you're just like, oh no, are they really going to do this? Are they going to tie Tony Stark to a little boy? Like that's going to be what this movie is. And then like they just use it perfectly and never too much. And it like actually really works well. And I feel like that's kind of how this worked for me also. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I could have used with like maybe one less cutback to him when they're in the final fight.
I think that's fair. Like one shot to show him doing the play dead thing and then just leave him be.
But also, like, it's fucking Academy Award-winning actor Ben Kingsley, and that's kind of insane. And he's just like, yeah, I'll just play this, like, kind of, like, drunken fool. Just be, like, seventh billed on the call sheet. Just, yeah, why not? It's just so crazy.
He looks like he's having the time of his life, so.
He really does.
So I know. Sometimes it's not even the paycheck. Sometimes you just want to have some fun.
Yeah. Not on
I'm sure the paycheck. I'm sure the paycheck was not too small. This is Disney money we're talking about.
I'm also pretty sure that he probably filmed all of his scenes in 3 days. So, like, if you notice in that like final, in like the final third of the movie, like when they're in Tao Lung and everything, like he's never sharing scenes with anybody else. So it's like they just shot all of that in one day and moved on.
Movie magic.
Exactly.
Imagination.
Any final thoughts on the movie?
Yeah,
it's good. Go see it. Just don't think about it. Go see it.
Yeah,
well, I think you should go see it and think about it. It's a rewarding experience.
Well, no, I mean,
don't think
too much about seeing it. Like, just go. Don't think about, oh, what are the reviews saying? Just go see it. But wear a mask. Yeah. But go see it.
Yes.
Or
I did that.
It'll be on Disney Plus for free in about a month. So if you can't or you don't feel comfortable watching it in theaters, you can watch it that way. Because it's certainly, there was concern about whether it would, you know, that the whole box office thing, will it pan out? Will it unfairly malign like this Asian American experience? Because it did, but it crushed at the box office. It made like all the money. So you no longer have to worry about that. You could just, if you don't feel comfortable going to a theater, definitely wait and watch it on Disney Plus, but definitely watch it nonetheless.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I'll just echo what you guys are saying. I think it's absolutely worth your time. I have to say, seeing it in the theater was helpful for a couple of reasons. One is because there were very few people in the theater, but the people who we're in this gigantic theater, we go in, like, we're the only two people there. Then, like, when the movie's starting, like, a family comes in and they happen to just be in the same row as us, like, in this giant theater. And they were kind of, like, at first I thought they were going to be distracting, but luckily the sound like kind of drowned them out. So I didn't actually feel distracted by anything. So I don't know if that's a, you know, that's like my, my pitch for going to see things in theaters, because sometimes the movies can be so overwhelming that you don't even have to worry about distractions. And I'm very glad, especially for this movie, that that was the case.
Yeah, I think the best compliment you could give a movie is that it was so good you forgot where you were.
Or who you are seeing it with, not by choice. All right, I guess we're going to move into our sort of broader topic on this, which is related to the movie. And it's kind of a general question, and I'm kind of curious where you guys are going to go on this, but I want to ask how you guys feel about how you think this movie will tie in with the Marvel Cinematic Universe going forward. We do get some post-credit scenes at the end. The first one is, it appears that there's a conference of some sort going on, trying to determine the origin of the Ten Rings, or the fact that there seems to be a beacon in them, and where is it coming from? And there's some interesting people in the audience. Yes, who is it calling? Who's calling them? There's some interesting people who are attending virtually, as we all do, as we all know so much about these days.
Even the Avengers have to do Zoom meetings now. It's really sad.
Well, but they clearly have like the Zoom Gold, Platinum, Premium Plus edition, not whatever shit we peasants are forced to scrounge for.
Well, they are in the future. Let's not forget. You know, it's 2024 by them, right?
I guess I don't remember.
But you've got Bruce 5 years. No, 2023. It's 2023. Yeah, it's 2023 in current Marvel.
All right, so in 2 years, guys, we're gonna have full 3D holoprojection. Yes, I think
of Brie Larson by default, because then that's a future I'm very much looking forward to.
But she has to leave all the time. It's really kind of frustrating.
Well,
can my 3D image be Saoirse Ronan? That would be my ideal future. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. Jack Loden might have something to say about that, but we'll see.
You can say it to my fist. Anyway.
Now I'm just imagining an Avengers, but like with the Wes Anderson universe instead of the Marvel universe.
But to get back to our question,
the Royal Budapest bottle rocket bombs.
But to get back to this movie and the MCU at large, what are you guys feeling with that? Do you think that these are people we've met that are responsible? You think this is a completely new part, corner of the Marvel Cinematic Universe? How are you feeling about it?
As someone who has zero background in the comics and therefore has no possible leads to chase down, it looks like either the rings are a type of new metal, a la the metal called?
It's not new, because they say that it's dated back to like before the start of the universe.
But it's not. What's the metal? Vibranium.
Yeah, they're very explicit. Yeah,
they said it's not vibranium, not so. Yes. It could be another type of substance, is what I'm trying to say, like another type of substance that we've not seen with yet, or representative of a different type of magic or cosmic power, or some combination of the two. I'm fairly certain that whatever entity or entities are involved in its creation is going to be something that, at least in the movies, we've not yet seen. Because it'd be really weird if it's like, oh, it's the ancestor of Thanos who created them, or something like that. Like something to call back to a previous villain, you know?
Yeah, well, I have to say, I think the thing that jumped out to me was how similar that scene where, a quartet of Avengers characters are meeting up with our heroes to discuss the origins of these rings, how similar that was to the end of the first Guardian of the Galaxy movie, where they're like, hey, Peter's DNA is kind of weird and ancient in a way, and we're going to get to that soon. And then it turned out to be that he was a part celestial. And as we know, Eternals is going to be heavily influenced by the Celestials, right? They were kind of the Eternals were created by the Celestials to battle mm-hmm. the Deviants. That is the thing that we're going to learn about this November. And the deal with the Celestials in the comics is that they're these like gigantic, like planet-sized beings who kind of set a bunch of stuff in motion and then come back millions of years later and are like, are you good or are you not good? And if you're not good, we're just gonna fucking destroy you completely. And I think that maybe that could be what the deal is here. Hmm. Like, it could be this is celestial technology that has fallen from the sky centuries ago into Wenwu's possession, and he used it for ill repute. They actually have a key moment introducing the Ten Rings in this film where they mention that he could have used it for good or for ill, and he chose for self-interest. And I think that kind of like that maps onto the sort of idea of the Celestials and kind of evaluating our society and stuff, and like whether we're making good choices or bad choices. So I think that the beacon is calling the Celestials home, and I think it's going to tie into something that we've seeing that we're going to be seeing in the Eternals, and that will kind of be building towards the towards something later on in the universe. Will it connect to Kang, which also seems to be a big thread that's going to be running through a lot of these movies in the multiverse, or will it be something else? I think is to be determined, but I could definitely see a sort of idea of, you know, there's heavy rumors that the next big Avengers event will be Secret Wars, where based off of the Jonathan Hickman Secret Wars comic book from a number of years ago now, where basically a bunch, like all of the multiverse collapses into each other, and like you have to fight it out to survive and create a new singular universe. And certainly we've seen the multiverse break open, and that seems to be a common thread running through a lot of movies in this current phase. And so my pet theory is that instead of the sort of plot mechanics of that Jonathan Hickman story, where of these incursions where universes were colliding into each other and they had to be destroyed, and I think what it's going to be is that the multiverse is going to be judged by the Celestials, and the Celestials are going to start destroying universes, and until they all kind of consolidate into the big Secret War Pansea universe that battles it out. So I think that that's what we're kind of headed towards. I think that it's going to be kind of marrying the Celestials to the multiversal wars that we've had teased. And I think this is our first little kind of glimpse at that.
I think given the fact that that is the most logical and easy to grasp explanation, that's probably going to end up being true. There are definitely comic book aficionados who are spitting much wilder and more complicated theories on Tumblr, but I'm fairly certain that Alex has got it mostly on the money.
Wait, so does this mean that the Celestials have their own TVA? That's what I want to know.
Well, you know, the TVA is really just a construct created by Kang to enforce his own supremacy on the multiverse. So.
Mm.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking more in terms of Kang, but that might just be because I know that he's going to be like a made, you know, like the sort of big bad going forward. It's funny, like until that moment, I hadn't really connected them with anything sort of interstellar, I suppose. Like that they're very like vague about it when they're describing the Ten Rings in that opening. Saying that, you know, he found them either in a tomb or perhaps in a volcano, and like you're like, okay, like I almost like at a certain point was like, I don't feel like I need to know where these things come from. So I was like, I guess a little surprised when I found out that it was connected to something bigger in the MCU. So I guess I don't know, it was a bit of a surprise to me, and then like the whole beacon thing was like really not on my radar at all.
I like about that is that the movie was strong enough to know that we didn't need to know the origins of the rings for the film to work, right? I think they kind of like waved it away in a very, very effective way. And
the legend, the legends say, but some legends say, and then they leave it at that.
Yeah, and that's all that we needed, and that was really good for the movie. I think that putting it this kind of question in the mid-credit sequence is a really good way to then connect some pieces of this into the larger universe. I think that it's like it was very well deployed in both senses. I feel like earlier Marvel may have tried to include some of that mystery inside of the film itself to the detriment of the film, or maybe, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. but I think that they were really smart to be like, no, for this story, they're just magical rings. It doesn't matter, you know, but there's potential for us to actually make that be something more meaningful in the future. So let's latch on to that after the movie. So that way we can kind of like, you know, I thought that was really smart.
So on, I have a question for you guys on a much more we're probing the edges of the known Marvel universe on a much more grounded level. Do you guys think that they're going to have Shang-Chi and his sister be in direct conflict with each other in a future movie? Some people are predicting that thought makes me sad.
I think so, for sure. I think that that's the best way to kind of replicate this kind of messy family dynamic that's at the core of this movie while losing the Tony Leung character. I think that's like the best choice to move forward with it. But I do also think that we're going to see her and the Ten Rings in another Marvel property before we get to a second Shang-Chi film, because they make a point in the end credits to say the Ten Rings will return instead of saying like Shang-Chi will return. And I think that that's teeing up the idea that they might be a kind of an antagonist for maybe a Disney Plus show or something like that before heading back to a Shang-Chi sequel.
Yeah,
I don't know. I feel sad at the idea of those two like being in conflict again after, to a certain extent, finding their way back to each other as family.
I mean, you know, that's families can be like that.
That's true.
I think that makes their relationship a lot more interesting, right? That there's this kind of core connection that they can't deny and that is incredibly powerful, but that they are fundamentally on opposite paths. And so in this one movie, those paths ended up crossing at a point, but they are now crossing in separate directions. And that is, I think, a really compelling kind of seed for a future story.
And there is something like very like it, when I saw that scene, I was like, OK, like pretty much what you get from the like you've heard about, like it's been mentioned by Shang-Chi that she is sorting out affairs in his, you know, in Wenwu's old empire. And I kind of figured that she was going to take over there. But I like the way that that scene is filmed because it makes it like surprisingly more menacing than you'd maybe expect. And I really like the way the camera just like gradually pulls out of this, you know, ostensible fortress, because it really does give you a sense of the scale and a sense of like the work that's being done. And, you know, maybe the question of like, why is that work being done? What is she preparing for? So there is like something a little more I don't want to say like it's more than just someone who's preparing for something, you know, just to prepare. It seems like something more deliberate than that, and maybe a little more concerning perhaps, but it will remain to be seen.
Yeah, and I think that I have faith in that character and in the writing team that they can really sell the idea that she feels like she is doing the right thing, even if she's embracing the darkness of her father in order to do that, right?
Yeah.
Like you could easily see this kind of the threads coming together where it's like, well, I felt like I could use his organization for good instead of for evil, but of course there must be strength and therefore I must be a little bit evil, you know, like that kind of deal.
Yeah,
that
sure.
I feel like we've seen before, but pinned to that emotionality that is so centered to the film, I think that it could work really well. I have faith in Destin Daniel Cretton and Dan Callahan, I believe.
I think so. Yes. Yeah. I didn't know until I looked it up later that that Cretton was also a writer on this. For some reason I thought he was. I thought he was just the director. And yeah.
Yeah. He and Callahan basically wrote this together. Is my understanding.
Yeah.
Which I think is also cool. You know, two Asian American writers getting the chance to write this script, and in addition to the Asian American director getting to direct it. I think that.
Yeah.
It shows, I think.
Do we have any other thoughts on this movie in general, or like on the MCU going forward?
I really liked the team that they kind of threw together for the Avengers sequence. The kind of a de-Hulk to Bruce, which is a is an interesting question that I'm sure will get resolved in the She-Hulk show later next year, which he's going to appear on. And then you have Captain Marvel, who is a central figure but is constantly leaving, which I really like about her, because this is the second time she's popped up in one of these things, and the second time she's like, all right, I'd love to continue talking, but I really am busy. So I really want to know what she's busy with at this point. I can't wait to find out. And then
when is the Captain Marvel sequel slated has that been announced?
Next November.
All right. Well, we'll find out then. They're filming it now. Damn important.
They're filming it right now, actually. Nia DaCosta is writing and directing it.
I think it's just I don't remember anyone else other than Wong, who was there with them.
And Wong, yeah, it was just the three of them, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're gonna see him in the next Spider-Man movie, and the next
we're gonna see him leave the next Spider-Man movie. I think Benedict Wong's job is to just like pop up to walk in and out of portals and just collect paychecks. Like, that's just his job now, and good for him. He deserves it.
Hey, you know, Samuel L. Jackson's basically doing the same thing, and I'm happy for him, man. He's earned it.
Yeah. Justin, do you have any mysterious theories around the Abomination and Wong training together at an underground fight club in China?
That was, yeah, I thought for sure we were gonna get an answer to that. So it's been so long since I've seen The Incredible Hulk. I think I saw it when it came out, and I barely remember anything about it. I did see that Tim Roth did do the voice here for Abomination, which I was like, wow. But
he's also going to be appearing in She-Hulk next year.
Oh, okay. All right. Everything that's old is new again. do I have any? That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think the thing that was interesting to me was it was pretty clear early on that they were staging these fights, like almost kind of made me think of like something like professional wrestling. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have any crazy theories about it. I just liked the dynamic between them, and I got a huge laugh out of Wong creating a portal so that Abomination could effectively punch himself in the face.
Yeah, so. Smart move by him.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. They seem to clearly be training together. Like, they've had this like established relationship for some reason somehow. And it's curious, like, to what end are they training? Like, the last time we saw Blonsky was he was arrested by S.H.I.E.L.D. and taken away. And he had been known to be in prison since then, in like this kind of secure S.H.I.E.L.D. Prison that was the only thing that could contain him. Yeah. Obviously, S.H.I.E.L.D. destroyed post Winter Soldier, and now we're like a decade after that in the timeline, so where he's been is an open question. And he certainly, the portal that they're going back into seems to be some sort of high-tech lab or something to that effect, so I there's a lot of questions. I'm very curious, but yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that factors into She-Hulk, which has been kind of pitched to us at least as like an Ally McBeal but starring She-Hulk.
Yes,
so I'm very curious, like, maybe, you know, Tim Roth is gonna pop up like seeking damages from the government, I don't, in like a lawsuit, I don't know. Just imagining
she's like representing him. Like,
yeah, I don't know, we'll have to find out. And yeah, also, you know, last time we saw Bruce Banner, he was Professor Hulk mode, and it seemed like he was going to be like that forever, but mm-hmm. now he's just Bruce Banner again. And yeah, so it's an open question there,
constantly flux.
Yep, but I have faith that we won't have to wait long to get answers to a lot of these questions, because mm-hmm. She-Hulk is going to be coming in the first half of next year. So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Hawkeye is
Why
the next
do you
one,
ask
right?
Questions to which you already know the answers.
Well, I don't know the answer. I just know when we'll find out the answer. It's not the same thing. Yeah, that's Hawkeye is next in terms of Marvel entries. Well, actually, technically, Eternals is next. Eternals comes out beginning of November.
Oh, yeah, right.
Hawkeye comes out end of November, and that trailer just dropped and looks really fun.
Yeah. I'll just also point out, assuming that Awkwafina keeps up with the bow and arrow training, does this mean we're going to have teachers in the MCU who are Kate's?
Awkwafina.
Okay.
Trademark.
I mean, that's got to be better than the Marvel Legends action figure that they released of her character that just refers to her as Marvel's Katie.
Wow.
Yeah. You should look it up. It's very funny.
All right. Well, on that note, we should close things up here. This has been really fun, guys. Let's talk about where we can find everybody. I'll start this time, and I will say you can find me on Letterboxd at The Cinemaverick. I also have a website, thecinemaverick.com. And how about you, Noah?
Well, you can see all of my written film reviews and other media musings on my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com. And as at the beginning of the show, we also got to do a plug for the Genesis podcast that Justin and I did, Pod on the Rooftops, which we both co-hosted along with my younger brother, who joined us for that as well.
Yes, Luke Martin, who also has another podcast on the Pop Break, which I am blanking on the name.
It's called Talking Lakota. A recent episode just came out on Billie Holiday, which is actually really great. So you should check that out.
Mm.
Yeah. You can find that podcast and all of the other podcasts that I supervise over at thepopbreak.com. Click on the podcasts tab. That's your fastest way to get access to all of the podcasts that we have. We have Socially Distanced, which has been covering Marvel's What If. So if you're interested in Marvel stuff, you can check out. They've been reviewing each episode of that show. We also have the Pop Break TV, which is a podcast hub focusing on television. Obviously, I have a podcast on there called TV Break. Comes out once a month. We have lots of other podcasts on reality shows and anniversaries of shows that have been in the news and all that kind of stuff. Also, you can subscribe to The Breakcast, which is our other podcast feed that Talking Lakota is on, in addition to several other things. So, yeah, that's all of my podcast stuff. You can also follow me personally on Twitter at Media Thinkings, and you can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings as well. I watched all of Wong Kar-wai's films over the summer. You can check out those reviews over there. You can also check out, I'm going to be watching all of Jane Campion's films in the next few weeks, so I look for little brief reviews of all seven of her films in the next few weeks as I get through those. And as for our show, you can follow our show on at Cinema Joes on Twitter for updates and links to future episodes.
Thank you for all of that, Alex. And we want to thank all of our listeners and our subscribers. Thank you so much for sticking with us. We will be back very soon. But for now, this is Justin Mancini for the Cinema Joes, signing off. It's a moment where, sorry, did you guys hear that?
No, you just stopped talking for a second.
Oh, I wonder if that was my connection. I just heard, anyway, that was really strange.
Oh no, the Dweller of Darkness is reaching Justin.